Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, and actually, the last edition of 2018. Off Camera's the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor Ron Livingston. When Ron Livingston was a kid growing up in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, he watched movies and thought being an actor meant you got transported to the environment of the film. As he describes it, "I watched Star Wars and thought the actors were actually going into space and flying the Millennium Falcon." Well, Ron eventually discovered this thing called a green screen, but his desire to act and be fully immersed in the experience didn't go away. A combination of talent and hard work, fueled by a mostly healthy dose of self-criticism, propelled Ron's career in projects like Office Space, Swingers, and Sex and the City. But it wasn't until he was on the set of Steven Spielberg's Band of Brothers, surrounded by military tanks, explosions, and everything else a soldier in a war zone might encounter, that Ron could look around and say, "Wow, when I was a kid, this is what I thought being an actor would be like." Removing the artifice is a theme with Ron, because the less he has to act and pretend, the more he can focus on being in the moment. As he says, "All I try to worry about is showing up and being a real person, ideally myself." He's taken that mindset to his most recent role in the dark comedy series Loudermilk on Audience Network as a former music critic and grumpy recovering alcoholic who runs recovery meetings. His technique for getting into character, you may ask? Going to some real-life AA meetings and going dry while he's working on the show. He says it makes me that extra little bit miserable for those 3 months. Perfect for a character like Sam Loudermilk. Ron joins off camera to talk about learning to listen to his instincts, why his self-critical voice is a blessing as well as a curse, and why his sleeping reel is so strong. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey, Ron.
Hey, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Absolutely.
I have to say right up front, I love Loudermilk, and it's on the same network as we are, on Audience Network, and one of the things that I love about being on that network is you can say anything, and literally everything has been said on this show, and they've never called us or censored us or said maybe you ought to tone it down, and I think that there's that quality with your show too, not only in the crassness of the language, but situationally that you can go wherever you want creatively. I think that's a really interesting way to make a show.
I don't think it'd be the same show without that.
Yeah.
Because I think part of the fact that we can just speak the way that, you know, some people actually speak, conversationally.
Yeah.
Is it's fucking awesome. And if you can't do that, it's just one more thing that starts to make it feel like, oh, there's a fictional TV show.
Right.
I mean, I've worked with development executives. You'd never hear them doing anything, and then you'd see them kind of huddled with the director or the writer. But I know exactly what you're talking about, and audience is definitely that way. I feel like there are a lot of networks, new networks, that are that way in the beginning, and then they get a couple of years of success under their belt, and they're like, "Well, we know what we're doing now, so we have this brand to protect, and we're gonna, you know."
Right.
But it does start to make the shows all look the same a little bit, you know. As an actor, one of the things when things came along, you go, "What is it? It's a CBS show? Okay, CBS show. It's an ABC show? All right, it's an NBC show." Those are three very different things. So you're like, okay, if I'm on this one, even if it doesn't start like that, it's gonna,
there.
You know, 10 episodes in, it's gonna be like that. And, and so you gotta be down for it a little bit.
Yeah.
You have to learn to pay attention to that.
I think it is sort of like important to protect those creative environments where someone gets to really have enough rope to either hang themselves or
yes.
make something totally original.
And that's the flip side. I think it's the only way the really great work happens. It's also a way that really terrible work happens.
You
know what I mean? Because if you just let somebody go and trust them, sometimes they're gonna, you know, run off a cliff.
Yeah.
But if you're cool with that, you know, you don't have to renew that show.
right.
You know, so all right, we tried that. That didn't work. But I think that's when that's when you're able to discover things and go, "Oh, I made a show like I haven't seen before."
Yeah, I think it is sort of a little bit like the Wild West right now.
in terms of all these networks shuffling around, and obviously this show has benefited from that. There's never been an audience employee in this studio, which
right.
I think is the biggest vote of confidence, you know, other than the messengers that come to pick up the drive.
You're
has
not
the
far
show
from El Segundo
it.
Either. So
we're not
they,
that
they
far.
Could be here.
Well, it's we haven't given like... them our address.
Yeah, I see it.
Well, let's talk about Loudermilk a little bit, because I have a theory about the show, about why a lot of people like it, is I think there is some wish fulfillment and some vicarious living that goes on when the lead character of a show gets to say and do exactly what they want. And I'm not saying he doesn't have consequences, but he just doesn't care about his consequences mm-hmm. so much. I think probably a thought that passes a lot of people's minds is, I wish I had said more of what I thought, or I wish I hadn't been so scared to share my opinion or to express what I really wanted out of life.
That's definitely a big part of it. That's part of the fun for me. You know, I go when I do Loudermilk, I wake up in the morning and I don't touch my hair. I walk in there, they look at it and go, awesome. And I go shoot the thing. And then the next day I do the same thing and it's completely, you know, we don't really use any makeup.
Right.
So it just gives it, there's a freedom to it.
Yeah.
And there's a freedom to be that guy that pisses people off. I think the thing that I love about it the most is he's a guy, the reason he's an asshole is because he sincerely believes in his heart of hearts that he has the ability to look at somebody and in 10 seconds discover all the shit that's wrong with them, and then he feels like he's the reason he's in this world is to tell them,
right?
And demand that they fix it.
And not worry so much if that ruins that relationship
no.
with that person.
No, because he doesn't give a shit about the relationship. He gives a shit about the thing of, like, you're ignoring this really annoying thing that you're doing or huge thing that you're doing that's fucking up your life, and you need to cut that shit out.
Now.
Now. And then the funny part is that he can't turn that off. So it's like he feels that way about the stupidest shit. And it's fun to play a guy that can never let it go, and he's always trying to fix the world, and the world is just telling him to fuck off. It's not in a hurtful, he's not an asshole because he wants to hurt people. He's trying to fix people, and you know, the beauty of it is then you make him this recovery group leader, and all of a sudden that quality is exactly the thing that these guys need.
It's sort of like tough love in the recovery room, whereas out in the world, it's like this frustrated misanthrope who doesn't understand why people don't see like him.
Just this miserable cuss.
Yeah. How do you originally wrap your head around that idea of playing a misanthrope?
It's not hard, actually. It wasn't hard for me because...
What does that say about you?
Yeah, I'm a somewhat miserable person with a... I was raised to have a very... high bar of self-criticism.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, which is definitely a blessing because you're constantly trying to reach higher. But it's also a curse because, you know, there's a lot of times when you beat yourself up too much. I've let go of some of that a little bit.
I feel like if you don't do this right, then you're not going to have other people going, well, that's what I would say too, or I understand why he said that.
I have faith in the idea that we're all similar enough that even somebody who doesn't necessarily think or feel that or hasn't been in that situation is going to look at it and go, oh, shit, I understand that.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then all of a sudden there's a human connection to it rather than trying to second guess what they're going to expect me to do. So, you know, as far as being the misanthrope, I play a guy who, for whatever reason, wakes up every morning miserable. And
but do you play him as miserable? I mean, or do you play him as, this is my world? You know what I mean? In other words, do you pass judgment on the fact that he's miserable?
When I did Office Space, Peter Gibbons starts off as a guy like that. He's a guy that everything in his life makes him miserable. You know, his job, his girlfriend, his, all of it. And the difference is that Office Space is a movie about a guy who just decides to give himself permission to not be miserable and walk away from all the shit that makes him miserable. And then he's happy, you know? I don't think Loudermilk's ever going to find that.
Right.
And it fits with the theme of recovery because you know, the idea of any 12-step program is this is a problem that's never going to go away. We're going to wake up every morning and have to fight this bear that's you know, going to try as hard as it can to kick our ass. And we're never going to be able to wrap it up in a bow and say, I did it, I'm done, I don't have to do that anymore.
That's a great point. That's probably the difference between people who actually succeed in recovery and people that don't, is the people that think it's a problem that they can be done with are the ones that don't succeed.
Yeah, they take their eye off the prize.
Right. So that brings up a question about how you sort of made yourself well-versed enough or researched that mindset of recovery. And
yeah. First of all, I've known people in recovery, so I've had a chance to see it. Second of all, there's always something in your life. If you have to play a murderer, you may not have ever killed anybody, but
we hope.
I guarantee you've stepped on a cockroach. You know what I mean?
Right.
So there's something in your history, in your past, that can make you understand that, like, oh, I did that because I thought it needed to be done, and I had no qualms about doing it. And I don't know if that's accurate to how a murderer actually thinks, but it means that I feel like I'm playing it the way I would do it if I was a murderer. So I'm not an alcoholic, but there's definitely a couple years where I drank too much,
right.
You know? And there's a couple years when I spent way too many hours playing cards, you know? So I understand, I understand that a little bit. And I went to a couple 12-step meetings.
Oh, you
just
did?
To get it. I'd been to some Al-Anon meetings before.
Al-Anon's
really, for years I never understood what the hell Al-Anon was about. Because we're not alcoholics. We have alcoholics in our family, and we're the ones here at the meeting? Like,
right.
What the fuck? I don't understand that. Why don't, they're the ones who, but if you look at it, everybody in that room is addicted to trying to prop up somebody else in their fucked up life. Codependent.
Or enabling.
Yeah. It's just this idea of not being able to wrap your head around, I'm a slave to this other person's sickness because I can't let my, my needs and understanding of how things have to go take power, take control. So that's Al-Anon, as in a nutshell, as a guy who's been to three meetings. I went to a couple of AA meetings, and it was really compelling. I dropped in at a meeting. I thought it was going to be what you see on TV. It's like rows of chairs and 50 people, and you get up at the podium and people talk, and you don't have to say anything. You know, you sit in the back and drink coffee and then leave, and nobody talks to you. I got there, it was like seven people sitting around a table.
So there's no hiding in the back row.
No, it was super intimate. Everybody, you know, like, you're gonna get into it with everybody.
So what happened to you in there?
Well, I have to be honest about it, right? So when it came to my turn, I'm like, I'm here because I'm, you know, doing this show, and I'm researching this thing, and I have to play it. So I want to see what it's about. But I'll tell you about, like, you know, my history with alcohol, because that's I guess that's what we're here to talk about. And I had a lot of people that, you know, and a guy offered, like, to be a sponsor or something, because I think a lot of people come into AA meetings saying, well, I'm just doing research for a friend. I don't have a problem and whatever. So they're like, okay, all right.
No, I think you're right, though. I think that is the case where it's like, well, this isn't for me, but I'm just going to check it out.
And when I did that, actually, before I did that, I don't drink when I'm shooting the show. About a month before the show, I go dry, and then I stay dry.
Now, why is that? Stay healthy, or?
Well, that's part of it. You know, that's not why I did it, but I definitely noticed there's like some stamina benefits of. You go to work hungover once, and it like messes you up for 2 weeks. It takes too long to catch up. No, I did it. for one thing is I knew I was going to go into these AA meetings, and there, it felt really disrespectful to be sitting in on this and with the idea of like, well, as soon as it's finished, I'm going to go have a beer. See you guys. Right?
Even though it's just a comedy.
Yeah, even though it's just a comedy, it helped me understand, it makes me that extra little bit miserable for those 3 months, which, you know, and yeah. It's, and there's...
And you're sort of like day to day.
People want to go out for drinks, and I have to say, no, I'm not fucking going out, you know, because I'm not, you know, or like I go and I have a soda and whatever, and you feel a little left out, and you feel on the outside, and you feel like what it's like to sort of wish you could just be like everybody else and do the thing, but you have this core, you know. So it's useful to me as a rehearsal of the thing, and it's one more thing I can check off the box and say, okay, so I'm actually doing this. I don't have to think about faking it, because I'll just actually do it. And then if you can check, you know, it's like, if you have to pretend there's a gunshot, that's really hard. If you have the AD standing over there with like two pieces of 2x4 and goes like that, you don't have to pretend it's a gunshot. You don't have to think about that. You don't have to plan how you're going to do that. It just happens and you, you know, you react to it. So it's just one less thing you have to act.
That's actually an interesting perspective of those things that aren't your lines, or they aren't an interaction and active listening or whatever, but just things that will ruin a performance if they just don't like human natural reactions. You know what it is? It's like watching someone in a film or television show that is sleeping and they wake up.
Mm-hmm.
I am the worst judge in that moment. I'm like, he's not really sleeping.
Yes. My sleeping reel is very strong.
It is.
Actually, some of my best work has been done in scenes where I'm sleeping and I wake up.
As an actor, do you, when you wake up, do you start going, oh, how did I do that? Like when you wake up normally at home and you're like, that was a really natural wake up. I got to remember how to do that.
No. I think you're supposed to. I feel like when I read Stanislavski, in college, that's you were supposed to keep a notebook, and if you remember Fame, the movie, they're like, brush your teeth. Remember how you're brushing teeth. Yeah. So there is an element of that.
Yeah.
Generally, more of the way I do it I'm a little more unconscious about it, and then I just know I have a good instinct for when I do it in a scene or on camera, whatever it is. I don't know if it looks fake or not. I know if it feels fake. And if it feels fake, I got to try to do it a different way. And then when it stops feeling fake, I'm good. And I don't even necessarily know what I changed or what I did or what it looks like or if it's good or not.
So you rely on intuition.
Yeah, I think you have to. All I have to try to worry about is show up and just be a real person, ideally yourself.
Hey folks, let's take a moment out of this conversation to talk to you about this week's sponsor, Quip, and about your teeth. One of the most important things we do for our health every day is brushing our teeth, yet most of us don't do it properly. Well, we're here to help. Quip is an electric toothbrush, and it's a better electric toothbrush, created by dentists and designers. It looks like it belongs on the space shuttle or on the USS Enterprise. It's sleek, it's modern, it's cool, but most of all, it works great. It was designed to make brushing your teeth more simple, affordable, and even enjoyable. I first tried Quip a while back now, when they first were getting started, and they sent some toothbrushes over to the show, and I was immediately hooked. The toothbrush is small, it's light, and it travels so well. It's got this cover that you can take off and stick to any mirror in any hotel, and when you're done, you slide it back over the bristles, and your toothbrush is clean, and it vibrates, and it makes your mouth feel good. And it's just a great, simple solution for a toothbrush. So I started using it daily, and then I got it for my kids, and we all use it, and it's just a great, simple product that solves a problem. I no longer have to have a toothbrush plugged in with a big base and worry about when the heads get old and crusty, because Quip takes care of all that. Brush heads are automatically delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5. That's right, you get Quip, And then every 3 months, you get a new brush head, you get a new battery, and you never have to think about it. So your toothbrush is always clean, and the bristles are always fresh. And it's just a great way to have a hassle-free experience. Now, as for the vibrations, they have sensitive sonic vibrations that are gentle enough on sensitive gums. And that's because a lot of people brush too hard with electric toothbrushes, and they're too abrasive, and they can actually harm your teeth. There's a built-in 2-minute timer that pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides. That helps guide a full and even clean. And that's because 30% of us don't brush for a full 2 minutes or don't clean evenly. As my kids could tell you, I'm constantly on them saying, that wasn't 2 minutes. And then Quip came along and they do the full 2 minutes. So that's a helpful thing. And this is kind of gross, apparently 3 out of 4 of us use bristles that are old, worn out, and ineffective. So don't do that anymore. Quip will help you have a cleaner toothbrush and a cleaner mouth. And Quip was one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association and has thousands of verified 5-star reviews. So I love Quip. I love it for its convenience. I love it for its space-age design. And I mostly love it because I know I'm getting a good brushing experience. And they're backed by over 20,000 dental professionals. So that's good to know. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/offcamera right now, you get your first refill pack for free when you buy a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/offcamera. That's getquip.com/offcamera. So check it out and brush your teeth. Now back to the show.
Do you as an actor ever find it necessary or helpful to sort of take the character out for a spin or to sort of try to be in that guy's mindset?
Yeah, I try to put it on before. It depends on the part. I did this little movie 3 or 4 years ago where I had to play Elvis, right?
Shangri-La Suite.
Hey, oh, well, homework. I played, you know, fat, bloated Elvis in the 70s, and it was really daunting.
Because he's like the biggest icon.
Yeah,
in pop
he's the biggest icon, and like there's just the strength of career. Blah, blah, blah. And I didn't have an Elvis impersonation, you know, like I don't have an impersonation of him, and I didn't know a super lot about his history, so I sort of had to just start and like be. It was really odd, you know, the people in your, like I had to kind of just be Elvis in my personal life for the 3 months.
Like at the dinner table and stuff?
Yeah, like the voice that I was trying to do the movie. I was doing it all day long, only because I knew that if I stopped doing it, I was going to panic and quit. If I stopped doing it, I was going to go, I can't fucking do this. I look stupid. I'm not Elvis. You know, Elvis is a legend. I'm not a legend. You know, but if you just stay in it and don't take it off, you know, then you're going to get to the finish line eventually. But it's not like that for all of them.
Right.
Right? That one I had to do that because it was terrifying. Band of Brothers, I did that. Also because it was terrifying.
Because of the personnel and the level of what this
thing
could be.
Yeah, you got Hanks, you got Spielberg, and you've got these...
And you're young, and you're like, I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm playing in the big leagues.
Yeah, and also these people are, you know, true heroes who are not well publicly known. So like if I'm playing Richard Nixon and I like get him wrong, it doesn't matter because everybody, you know what I mean, has enough information about Richard Nixon to just know that Ron's a bad actor on that day, right? But if I'm playing Lewis Nixon and I get him wrong, I'm seriously doing this guy a disservice.
Right.
Who deserves better. So that was really immersive. That one we...
On Band of Brothers.
On Band of Brothers. We did, like, they set up a boot camp for us. I knew those guys for 2 or 3 years before we started calling each other by our real names. We called each other character names throughout the thing, and we called each other character names then for a couple years after because that's how we knew each other.
Is that sort of the dream for an actor?
It is. It absolutely is. I remember saying when we were doing... We were maybe 4 or 5 days into the boot camp. And I know it sounds kind of douchey to say, oh, you're actors at boot camp. But, you know, basic training is, a lot of it is just a serious mind fuck. You know what I mean? They're like, we're going to mind fuck these people for 6 weeks or whatever it is, because they're going to be in positions where they're getting mind fucked and they're under a lot of stress and they got to be able to handle it. So they were mind fucking us, you know, even on the fake one, to as much as an extent that they could get away with. And the thing that was kind of fantastic about it was it's like a 24-hour rehearsal where you don't ever step out of the character. So you really get in there deep. And I remember saying to Damien, there was a moment.
Damien Lewis.
Yeah, when we were doing some exercise and I broke it for a second, said, you know, this is the, when I was a kid, this is what I thought being an actor was going to be like. I thought being an actor, they were going to teleport you in, like, if you were making Star Wars, you were actually going to go to space and fly the Millennium Falcon. It wasn't going to be, I'm sitting in a chair in front of a green screen, and then they're going to add all that shit later for the audience. And Banner Brothers was like that. They added all that. That stuff was all there from, you know, it was around you. You didn't have to imagine the tanks coming over the hill because the tanks came over the hill. You didn't have to imagine the shells dropping because, like, all of a sudden something would blow up next to you, you know.
And it's like when you're a kid and you see the monkeys and you think, oh, bands live together.
Right. Yeah.
And that's why I want to be in a band, because I want my best friends that I play music with, I want to live there.
They didn't live together? Ever?
You know, but what you're saying is it's so spot on about why we initially get attracted to the things we're attracted to, because they consume us and they're so exciting.
Yeah.
And I think what you're talking about is you got that experience of being an actor is a full-time, like, I get to do it all the time, and I love it, right?
Yeah.
And that's so rare. But it sounds like to me, even with Loudermilk, that it does ride the line between comedy and drama in the sense that it's a serialized show, and there are storylines that have very dramatic arcs to them.
Yeah.
And then there's some pretty broad humor as well.
The thing that about the drama is, If we're over here being this broad in the comedy of it, and it's not about anything serious, then this is just all frippery, or, you know what I mean? We're just, you know, in comedy, you have to play the gag, right? We got to hit the punchline, we got to hit the gag. So what's the gag? The gag is, you know, so-and-so says this and this, and then I land the thing, and you got to stick the landing on that. You know, do the pratfall or whatever. In drama, you got to play the stakes. You're always trying to keep you have to keep the audience believing that there's something actually really important at stake that's going to be affected by what happens in the next 10 or 15 seconds. And so there's something about because we're dealing with the very life and death issues around alcoholism and addiction and recovery. The stakes are baked in, right? When this group of people is sitting around the room, you know, at the support group, just knowing in the back of your head that any one of these guys could, you know, slip tomorrow and be sleeping in a curb 3 months from now and be dead 6 months from now, that gives us stakes so that we don't have to play.
Right.
And likewise, if we were just doing the stakes and the drama of alcoholism and we're trying so hard, eventually it's just people, you know, like, come on, you know. So, and I think that's the way that I discovered the 12-step meetings actually work. They're freaking hilarious, you know what I mean? People's stories, people's anecdotes, the gallows humor that comes along with it, they need it. I don't think it works. It doesn't work without that.
Right.
So to me, that's what drew me to the thing. And I was nervous at the beginning. I got on the phone with Pete for the very first phone call where we talked about it.
Yeah.
Pete Farrelly, yes. Because I'd only seen the pilot. And I was like, okay, so is this a show where we're just the pilot, we're going to repeat this like thing over and over again? You know, like a classic sitcom.
Yeah, like Cheers.
Like Cheers or, you know, All in the Family. Both great shows, but they have a certain structure, you know. Carla's never going to one day be sweet and nice.
Or dead.
Yeah, or you're right. It's not going
right.
to, that's not going to happen because that's how the show's built. And so we're always resetting at the beginning. And that's because then you can watch them in any order and you don't care.
Right.
I was like, is this, because of course I knew Peter from Dumb and Dumber.
Sure.
Something About Mary. Brilliant, brilliant stuff, but not, kind of not what my reel looks like. Not necessarily my wheelhouse directly. Like, I don't know how good I'd be at doing that, just that, and having to, you know, land those gags every single time. And he was like, no. This is a show. We're gonna go on a road trip at the end of the season. You know, like, it moves forward. Everything that happens affects what happens next. We're doing both. We're playing it that way. And then it got really exciting to me.
Well, in the show, you play a former rock critic.
Yes.
And a minute ago, you brought up that you're self-critical.
Yes.
And it made me curious where that comes from. And I guess I was curious about your upbringing and how you became so self-critical.
Yeah. Oh, it came from my dad.
Oh, really?
My dad is extremely self-critical. He's gotten better, you know, but was very, very self-critical. Thought it his sort of sacred fatherly duty to teach us to be self-critical and to show us how
right.
to criticize ourselves so that we would know. And yeah, I mean, and I don't think my life wouldn't be sitting in this chair if I hadn't been raised that way.
But, because you pushed yourself. And you
yeah,
were
yeah,
yourself.
It made me always get, I pushed myself, you know. But, yeah, you know, it can be too much sometimes. So that makes the show really personal to me.
So you doing a little of your dad?
Oh, I'm more than a little. It's probably 50-60% of the character is me and my dad kind of merged into one, because I'm not really sure where one stops and one ends anyway. If I think of it as playing my dad, I get a lot more enjoyment out of really going with it and sort of sending it up. If I think about it as me, it maybe gets a little more you know.
Right.
But no, it's familial, you know what I mean? Like it's...
Yeah, eventually, that critical voice that you hear growing up, you just sort of... you internalize it,
and
it becomes literally, you carry your dad around with you, and you're off working.
Yeah. Eventually, it's not your dad anymore. It's you. You know
right.
what I mean? It's you saying all those same things, you know, because, like, he did his job. You're alive. You're 18 years old. You know what I mean? Like, he's good. You know what I mean? He can check it off. It's up to you whether you're not going to get rid of that voice, I don't think, ever, but you can change your relationship to it. You
can yeah, that's realize, a good question.
You
can
realize,
you
know what, that I don't work for that voice anymore. That voice works for me, right? I did this, it's kind of woo-woo, and I'm embarrassed even. No, I'm not that embarrassed. I should be. I used to do a thing when I got really self-critical, and a lot of times it'd be right before I was going in for an audition when I was first starting out. You get really jittery and nervous, and I'd be running it, and I'd get down on myself and like start to spiral into like, I suck. God damn it, I suck. I can't. How are we gonna do? I'm not gonna fucking get this. But you know, you gotta leave in 5 minutes. So I discovered this thing where I could look at the mirror. Take that critical voice, put it on the guy in the mirror. So that's the guy in the mirror that's talking to me. And now all of a sudden, I'm the guy who can actually move around and decide where we go. And I can look at the mirror and say, hey, it's okay, man. Take the day off. I got this. We're gonna be fine. You know, I appreciate the input. I really do. And I love the notes that you gave me yesterday. And if you think of anything, let me know, because I'm sure I'll make
the thing
better. I suck.
I'm never going to do it. Good notes.
Yeah, good notes. Great notes. I'm going to set them over here for now, and I'm going to go do my thing. And, so in a weird way, it's not that that voice goes away anywhere. It's like I changed my relationship to it.
When you describe the memory of that mirror discovery,
yeah.
What period of your career was that?
Definitely my 20s. It was before Swingers. It was before I ever got a job that anyone would have ever seen.
So you had gotten to a point where those moments before going into auditions or whatever, it became unhelpful to have that critic.
Absolutely. Living in that voice, Loudermilk has a thing that happened this season where Sam decides he's going to start writing again, but he's not going to write music criticism, which was always just listening to something and telling everybody what was wrong with it,
right,
why it was good. He's going to have to create something that actually comes out of him. And what he discovers is he can't get past the first sentence because everything that starts to come out, you know, every little green shoot that starts coming out of the soil, the critic voice has to stub it out and tell it how much it sucks, and then there's nothing.
And could you relate to that?
I could totally relate to that. It can go too far and you can get lost in it.
Do you have a memory of those early days auditioning where your critic actually won and took you out of something you maybe could have gotten?
Oh, sure. I mean, all the time. Some buddies and I used to, we would talk about it like, hey, you got to fight the dragon, you know, a little bit. I still get nervous I was nervous walking in here, you know. The thing that's changed a little bit is that I've accepted, oh, so that, yeah, that's just a thing that happens before you do something, and that's fine. You know what I mean? Like, that's a normal thing. It's to the point now where if I have a big scene and I'm not at all nervous about it going into it, I start to think, okay, I might be in trouble here. I got to follow this. Let's see where this is taking me, but I got to pay attention because, you know, something different is happening.
Yeah.
I probably have a depressive personality. I didn't call it that. Because I'm from the Midwest and we don't have that, so you just say he's just low key.
When you say we're from the Midwest and we don't have that,
yeah,
do you mean that traditionally in the Midwest people don't talk about their personal problems them as depression or anxiety?
There aren't mental, like, it's different now. You know, it's a new age now. But when I grew up, you don't have mental health problems. You're either fine, or you're batshit crazy. And nobody wants to be batshit crazy. So you're not gonna go see a psychiatrist or a psychologist. You're not gonna do any of that shit. It was like you think of it as a character flaw rather than, oh, this is just something that's either chemical or behavioral or whatever, and like I gotta work with it.
It sounds like there wasn't an avenue to go, wait, how do I fix this?
I was always pretty introverted.
You were?
Yeah, I was the kid that had to be sort of pushed to go outside and play because I could just sit up in my room and read all day. I think the identity that I kind of built for myself was the sort of the smart kid.
Right.
You know? Like I was going to be the kid that was really smart. Like scary smart, like that was.
And
that
was where I would have this power. What was the motivator for that?
A lot of it is that my dad felt that was important and that was the most important thing. That's why you go to school, is
right,
to get as smart as you can and get as good of grades as you can, and then you're gonna go. I think once you start doing it, like once you, if you're the kid in third grade who knows all the answers, it makes the teachers happy, right? They feel like they're doing a good job and they give that kid like some extra special love and whatever. It makes you feel sort of desired and wanted. And, you know, so there's a thing with that. But it's also, it's kind of a trap too.
How so?
It makes you afraid of failure.
Right.
You can't afford to fail because if you fail, you've lost. You've lost your thing, your mojo. And if you can't fail, if you're not afraid to fail, then you can't take the kind of risks that you're going to have to take to really jump to another level or unlock a whole new, you know, level.
Well, it makes me curious because I know you went to Yale.
Yes.
And and you were the smart kid,
yes.
And you pleased your parents and
yes.
pleased your teachers and stuff. But then somehow you found this profession where failure is the main ingredient in,
yeah,
in
yeah.
terms of the amount you have to handle to get somewhere.
It didn't feel like a big gap because it kind of went like that. It's like I started, you know, I did the sixth grade play, and then I did the seventh grade play, and then I did the eighth grade play. And
so you found out you liked it then.
I found out I liked it then, and it had something. And it does actually appeal to the introvert thing because it's like, I don't like going to a room full of people and talking to them. But I can go into a room full of people where they're sort of all in chairs, and I can just do my own thing. And then that's there was something that was really, I don't know, freeing about expressing yourself up on a stage in a way that was, because that's very, you know what I mean? There's a lot of internal.
Yeah.
Mostly it was just like, I did that. I was good at it. It was something that, it was one of the only things I had that that critical voice couldn't go, oh, you got third place? Who got second place and first place? Right? Because it's a play.
It you didn't have I mean? An there's objective no, judging
yeah,
system.
There's no quantitative measurement of whether you're doing well or not. So that was really freeing.
So that felt like less pressure than,
yeah.
What did you get on the test? What did everyone else get on
yeah,
the test?
Yeah, or you know, the wrestling tournament or something where are you, what seed are you, you know?
Yeah.
And then I enjoyed it. I had a little aptitude for it. So I got a lot of experience with it by the time I even went to school. So for me, really, the gap was, you know, when you being an actor in Iowa is like being a softball player in California, right?
Right.
Like, that's awesome. You can have a really great, fulfilling experience being a softball player. You're not going to be a professional softball player because we don't have any professional softball teams.
Right.
So
right.
It's like a hobby. So that was the big gap for me, was getting to a place of giving myself permission to say, oh yeah, you know what, I could probably, what they're doing professionally, maybe it's better, but it's not qualitatively different from what I'm doing as a hobby. So I don't know, let's try it. I remember, I think I must have floated the idea. I think in ninth grade, I wanted to job shadow. I went to the community theater so I could job shadow theater director, which is the closest thing. I was like, I want to job shadow an actor. And they're like, okay, we can get you a news anchor or we can get you a community theater director. I was the second one. I was the second one. You know, and I sat in a thing and watched some auditions and whatever. So it must have been in there. I think I was thinking about it. And I do remember having a conversation with my dad where I floated it as like something I might want to be. And he very reasonably said, well, how are you going to do that? You know, kid from my... And I remember saying, well, somebody's got to do it. Like, they got to come from somewhere. And he actually talks about, like, he's gone back. He's really proud of that conversation because he was like...
That he didn't totally dissuade you?
Well, no, I mean, I think he really, like, that was when he was like, my kid's got a plan for his life. You know what I mean? Or he's like, my kid's growing up. This kid really believes in himself. You know what I mean? Like, how is this kid... Wow, he believes in himself, you know? So... It sounds like it could be a terrible, you know, story about my dad, but it's actually a really kind of fond bonding memory that I have. I remember I had a chance to go have drinks with, like, the Chicago Cubs because they were in town, and a friend of mine was on a show, and they had a tie-in with the thing, whatever. So I get a call that says, I'm going out to drinks with the Chicago Cubs. You want to meet me there? And we'll, you know, and I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll go to drinks with the Chicago Cubs. That sounds kind of cool. And these guys all sat in a big circular booth and talked baseball the whole time.
Right.
This is after a game, you know. And I realized, like, okay, these guys are obsessed baseball nerds, right? In the way that I'm an obsessed nerd about my things. And that's why they can do this. That's why they're so good. And that's why they love it, you know? Like, because you have to love it to put in all those hours. I was really arrogant. I mean, I was a really cocky, I mean, people might say that I'm still that way.
I wouldn't say that.
Okay, well, thank
you. Not so far.
Not so far, yeah.
The day is young.
But yeah, there's something about that, that being young, I think you kind of almost have to have that. I've gotten the question before of like, were you surprised when your career took off, or were you surprised when this movie was a big hit? And you know, the honest answer is no. I thought they were all going to be big hits. I thought my career was going to take off when I was 23 because I thought I was the greatest shit since sliced bread, you know? And I think you need that to get over the hump of that first, you know, big obstacle course wall you got to climb. You gotta really believe something that may not actually be true yet. And once you do that, it kind of makes the rejection, like, awesome. I mean, the rejection doesn't hurt you anymore because you go into the thing certain that you're going to get this. I'm obviously going to get this. Why wouldn't I get this? I mean,
what about guy in the mirror?
Watch how great I am.
What about that guy?
I've left. He's gone. He's back at the house. He's in the mirror. He's along for the ride.
I mean, what you're talking about is pretty complex because you do have that guy too.
Here's the thing: I think the stuff that we believe has to predict what's actually going to happen, right? We're trying to predict what's actually going to happen. If I live my life that way, I would go to every audition going, there's very low likelihood that I'm going to get this, you know?
Right, if you took it scientifically, you'd be like...
And even if I do, there's a very low likelihood, it's probably still going to be terrible. And I would have to do that really for all of them, you know? So there's something that it's so much easier to go into all of them thinking that you're going to get it. And then when you don't get it, you just go, oh, well, I guess that obviously must mean I'm going to get the next one, you know?
I wonder if that's an innate quality that you're either born with or you're not.
I don't know. I mean, I definitely know some of it's learned, and I know auditioning is something that when you don't do it for a while, it gets harder. So I think it's practiced, but I'm sure there's probably some of it that's, you know, that people are built for it. You know, it's not a coincidence that if you look at, you know, the population of TV and movie stars, you're going to find a lot of megamaniacal narcissists in there, right?
It's what it took to get there.
It's not necessarily that the job made them that way. I think it's like, because that's what you need to actually get to that thing.
It makes me wonder if when you did get to L.A. pre-Swingers, mm-hmm. what sort of the biggest misconception in your own head was about what L.A. was going to be like?
I came with kind of zero expectations. The very first pilot that I tested for was called Going to Extremes. It was a Falsey Brand pilot, who are the people that did Northern Exposure.
Okay.
So this was like after that. I think it was Med Students in Grenada was the, you know, the
sure.
setup.
I don't know why that wasn't a hit.
Yeah, you know. Well, because I wasn't on it. But I tested for it, and that's a big deal because that's when you test for it, there's a contract that you sign.
Oh, so you didn't live in L.A. when
I lived in Chicago. I was living in Chicago. So that
it.
Was a... I tested for it in Chicago.
Okay.
It was a moment when they decided that it was a downturn in the business, and so they were like, just send us the thing on VHS. So the L.A. guy went in live. The Chicago guy was me, sent in a VHS, and the New York guy sent in a VHS. And the LA guy got it, and I immediately said, I gotta move to LA, right? Because there's no way that guy was better than I was.
Because VHS is terrible quality.
I've discovered the problem. I don't live there. I gotta go live there.
Right.
So that was the impetus. As far as a plan, there wasn't much of a plan. I had a family friend, that lived up in Northridge and offered me like the Fonzie room behind the garage for a couple of months.
Right.
So I had that. I had a friend who was doing, low-budget theater, so I had a chance to get kind of involved with that. Yeah, and I could type 60 words a minute, so I was, I could temp for a living. And that was really the plan, and for about the first couple years, really, that's the only thing I got. I didn't even get that many auditions.
Was Swingers a pretty good sort of facsimile of your life in LA at that time?
Oh, yeah. And not only is it authentic that we had that, those were the guys. There's no way, the only reason I was in Swingers is that John Favreau was the only guy that I knew in LA. He introduced me to Vince, and we spent, a year or two playing video games and going to the Dresden and going to the Derby.
That was a documentary.
Yeah, and stumbling around trying to pick up girls and not being good at it at all except for Vince. It's like watching home movies for me.
Really?
So it's one of those where I really, maybe an opportunity like that would have come up if Jon Favreau hadn't thrown that to me. But, certainly the fact that he did, really, that changed everything.
How did that rub off on you in terms of Jon sort of writing and making that film himself? Did that have an effect on you?
No. No, it didn't. I wish it had. I wish it had. Because I think if you look at, you look at guys like Matt Damon and...
Right, and Good Will Hunting. And,
they have that sort of self-agency. There's a little bit of mogul in them.
Right.
They're a little bit of a producer mogul. So John was a producer mogul, also brilliant comedian, really talented artist, animator. I don't really have that in me. I would go into meetings and people would go, all right, so what do you want to do next? And my answer was almost always, I don't know, but what do you got? You know what I mean? I'll know it when I see it. If I read it and it jumps off to me, or if you tell me about it, I can get excited about
right.
it and I can be a partner. But if I have to come up with it and write it and say, I want to play a senator from Philadelphia who is divorced, I can't do that, because I never would have come up with the idea for Loudermilk. I never would have thought, I want to play an ex-rock critic.
Isn't that funny, though? Because it's obviously a great role for you, and something where you found this incredible connection to, putting your dad in there, and your understanding of your own, and yet,
It's right in my wheelhouse, but it's a wheelhouse that I didn't know existed. I feel like there's two kinds of actors.
Yeah.
There's the kind that when they finish a job, they're like, oh my God, I'm unemployed. And there's the actor that's like, hey, I'm on vacation, right? So I don't think of it as unemployment. I think of it as I get 6 months vacation a year.
Right.
And I don't have a big overhead. You know what I mean? I didn't then. I do now. You know, once you have kids, yeah, that's the.
You're like, I better figure out my wheelhouse.
The second I started getting nervous about that was when my first kid was born, and then all of a sudden you're like, okay.
It made me think about Office Space, because you were what, 30 when you made that film?
I think so, 99, 32.
Okay, So at that point, Office Space comes along, it's Mike Judge, you get the lead role. I would assume that after making a film like that, there would be a different level of engagement and interest from agents, and a different level of expectation from you on, well, now I can carry the lead of a film.
Yeah.
So I was curious, when you went through that, if there was some expectation that sort of got added on to your general philosophy that sort of you had to work your way through.
Yeah, I mean, that experience for me was, because of course I assumed that Office Space was going to be a box office smash, right?
Given what we say about it.
Yeah, and it's so damn funny. Once it became clear, really in the weeks preceding its release, because you realize, I haven't seen any commercials or posters, ads for this. So I guess it's... once that happens and it sinks in, is like, oh, it's not necessarily. It's still a big enough plum you know, I moved to a different agency, had a very fancy, very fancy agency. And yeah, there was a little bit of that. But the way Hollywood is built is they're like, okay, so what's the next zany, like, broad comedy-ish thing that you want to do? And I was immediately like, I want to do drama, right? Like, I want.
You didn't build on Office Space by going and finding.
No, no. I was like, okay, I just did that. That was awesome. I want to go do, I want to do drama. And they looked at me like I was crazy. Because the thing was, is I wasn't a comedian. You know, like, I was a nerd in high school plays and who did Shakespeare and stuff. And so when I first started out going to audition for sitcoms in L.A., they were like, he doesn't do comedy. He's not a comedian. And because I'm not really a comedian, you know? Then you have some success at that, and they go, oh, he can't do this. He's a comedian, right?
Right.
And I just didn't feel that way, and I felt like I didn't want to get stuck in it. So, but yeah, your career is very different, because when the momentum is going this way and you want to go that way, and then the momentum's going this way and you want to go that way, you don't get as far,
right.
You know? But I think it's the only way that I wouldn't change a thing about it. It's the only way that I know to do it, because it guarantees that I'm going to be excited about the next thing I do as I was about the last thing I did, because it's just as new and different as that was.
I think that it would be very strange to have a success at something where it was sort of an accident and then say, now I'm going to be that guy and I'll know how to repeat that success.
Yes.
And I also think with your particular appeal in Office Space, but also sort of throughout your career, there's a quality of, I'm looking at you going, I would make that decision too. Oh, I would have done that, you know?
Yes.
And I think that in Office Space, you are the vehicle for us to all say, that's me.
Mm-hmm.
And as lovely as a trick as that is to be able to pull off, it's probably underappreciated as to how hard it is to do. And it's probably really hard as an agent to say, oh, I know how to groom you for that next thing. A lot of things have to fall into place for a film to work like that.
Yeah, I wasn't built to be a matinee idol. I don't have the skill set. It doesn't interest me. I felt awkward trying, and I tried to do it for a couple of years. You get to a certain point and your agents are like, we're gonna move, you know, you're gonna be the...
How did that feel? Did that feel like pressure?
Really awkward, you know?
It did.
Because now all of a sudden I'm in a leather jacket leaning up against the thing doing a photo shoot.
Your Men's Journal
something. And I'm trying to do that and I felt ridiculous, you know what I mean? I felt ridiculous doing that. And I felt the same way that I felt at the sixth grade dance, you know what I mean, when you're too scared to talk to the girl. Like, I was terrible at it.
What you're talking about is the matinee idol is the extrovert who, like,
yeah,
likes the attention and the...
The matinee idol, the thing that, the skill set is like, I'm gonna be cooler than you. I'm gonna be tougher than you. I'm gonna be funnier than you. I'm gonna be smarter than you. You're gonna watch this movie and you're gonna wanna be me.
You're gonna wish you were me.
You're gonna wish you were me, and that's gonna propel you through the movie. And we need that. We need big, you need big people. You need somebody's gotta be Lady Gaga. You know what I mean? So that you can go, oh, wow. Wow, that can exist, oh my God.
So you can feel crappy about yourself.
Yeah, no, I think I realized way before Office Space that I was an everyman, you know, where I'm not cooler than you, I'm not smarter than you, I'm not funnier than you, I'm not better looking than you, and when you see me in a movie, you're not going to say, I want to be that guy, you're going to say, I am that guy, right?
It's a subtle difference, but it's all the difference in the world.
I am that guy, and that means I'm in the movie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm a conduit for the people sitting in the chairs to actually have the story be about them rather than watching the people that they, aspire to be.
Yeah.
And to me, there was, that just fit my skill set a little bit. It is more interesting, and that's a thing in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Cary Grant was a matinee idol. Jimmy Stewart was an everyman. So you got to have some of both, and there's slots open for it. And and I felt that. So I kind of gravitated towards that right away.
I think that to have enough self-awareness to go, that's where I am, because I'm sure there's a lot of disappointed actors that had too high of expectations, maybe because they got a taste of it like you or whatever, and went away from what they could have done great because they had some demand. And I would imagine that when you start getting that sort of pressure from outside too, it's like, well, if I don't try to be that, then am I not fulfilling what I could be?
Right.
And then it could be unhappy.
I could be Tom Cruise.
Right.
I could be, you know, like, I could be, but if you try it on and it doesn't feel right, and that's really, that's kind of the story about Office Space. He's supposed to want to be a software engineer. You know what I mean? He's a professional. He's supposed to want to, you know, have this girlfriend. There's all these things he's supposed to want. He doesn't want them, right? At the end of the movie, the guy's with a shovel on a construction site, I'm sure for less money than he was making the week before, but he's happy.
Right. It's a lesson in listen to your gut and see what it is that and stop. I mean, it's sort of exactly the message of you know, corporate America, which is put a big billboard up and say, this is what you're supposed to want. And if you don't want that, there's something wrong with you.
Dior. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like you see that and you need that or something. You give me a lot of credit when you say, you know, that you had this self-realization. It wasn't like, I'm this and I'm going to be this. I just know that when I was trying to do the one, I felt awkward and dumb and it didn't go well. And when I tried to do the other one, I felt loose and free and I had more success with it. So it was kind of a no-brainer to just go, I'm going to do this one because that one feels terrible.
That might be your solid Midwest upbringing right there.
It might be.
Like knowing
it might be.
This works for me, it feels good, not having to shoot for the moon, but and then you find satisfaction in your career.
Yes. I feel like that's the answer to life. And I'm not able to do that, but I'm able to try to do that.
Yeah. Well, listen, obviously, great things are coming from that very simple philosophy. And I've just really enjoyed hearing where you came from.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's really interesting to hear how you got here and the way you think about your career. And I'm looking forward to more Louder Milk and more of you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thanks for doing this.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Hey, folks, that's our show. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. You can catch Ron Livingston right now on ABC's A Million Little Things and also on the Audience Network's Louder Milk. And it is an added bonus, when you're at the Audience Network, you can see this very show on television. If you don't have Audience Network, now's a perfect time to get it. And you can find out all the details about our TV show by going to offcamera.com as well. There you can find out details about how to subscribe to the podcast, how to see our television show, how to read our magazine, and how to buy stuff that supports the show. Specifically, if you're loving this podcast and you haven't subscribed yet, take a minute and go to iTunes and subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. While you're there, leave us a rating and a review. That helps other people find our show, and that helps us keep doing the show. And then, over at offcamera.com, you can also check out our television show. And if you don't have Audience Network, you can also see our show through our monthly subscription. For only $4.99 a month, you can see every episode we've ever made on any device as many times as you like. It's a great way to dive deep into the show and also to support us. So check all that out. You can find us on social media. We are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I'm Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. You can also send me an email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. We love to hear guest suggestions and ideas for the show. So if you have one, go on social media, tell us who you'd like to see, and who knows, maybe in 2019, we'll have your favorite actor, or your favorite musician, or your favorite director on the show. Well, folks, that's our show and our season.
and our year. I can't believe it's already the end of 2018, and we have done over 175 off-camera shows. I feel so lucky to be able to have these conversations every week with the most talented, unique, and hardworking artists of our time. And I really just want to take a moment and thank everyone that makes this show possible. First and foremost, I want to thank Audience Network, along with DirecTV and AT&T, for believing in off-camera and letting us make a show without compromise or supervision. To have the trust and support of a network like Audience has been a huge thing for us. I want to single out Heather Davis, Dan York, Kelly Beck, and, although they are no longer at the network, Chris Long and Bart Peters, for originally believing in the show. I also want to thank our own staff. I'll start with Crawford Shippey, my partner in crime, and the most calm and collected person I have ever met. The building could be falling down around us, and Crawford would just smile and tell me it was going to be fine. His combination of southern charm, business acumen, and true kindness is rare in this world, and I'm lucky to have him by my side. Then there's Nathan Shields, who's been with us since the beginning. He taped the first microphone to the shirt of our first guest back in 2013, and has made our technical operation run smoothly ever since. His ability to make the show sound good is only eclipsed by his ability to make the show look good, and he proved it when he took over as our chief editor a while back. Having Nathan in the room, at the controls, and in the conversation makes the show what it is, and we are eternally grateful to him. Michaela Galvin is our graphics whiz, and our camera operator, and our Photoshop expert, and our writer, and it's rare to find a brain that can handle that many disparate tasks. Just don't ask her to handle them before 9 a.m. But seriously, her dedication and love for this show, and for my daughters, and for really good snacks at around 3 p.m. every day is invaluable to us, and we are lucky to have her. Sasha Snow holds the whole office together and does so many things behind the scenes without question or credit that it's easy sometimes to forget just what a hard job she has. Every organizational happening in our studio runs across her desk, as do all the mundane tasks like making sure there is coffee and catering and batteries and such. And it's amazing to me that one person can handle it all. So thank you, Sasha, for not letting the building fall down around us. Then there's Kara Johnson, who takes every word emanated from every guest's mouth, and all of my words as well, and writes them down. From the beginning, Kara has transcribed the entire oral canon of off-camera, which is a monumental task. She also manages to do it so quickly that we secretly think she has some crazy software or is actually hiding somewhere in our studio. And last, and in this case least, Matt Davidson, who really doesn't do anything except pop his head in here every now and then to make funny, sarcastic comments and eat our food and drink our beverages. But somehow, Matt's presence gives this whole place the missing ingredient of pathos and ethos that keeps us all going. Well, not really, but it sounded good. And most of all, I owe a giant thank you to you, every listener and every watcher and every reader of Off Camera. It's been astounding to see the level of interest and engagement, the letter writing, and the love for this show over the years we've been doing it. I feel so lucky that I can make a little show in our little studio, and it has the power to reach artists all over the world, and hopefully in some small way, inspire them to make their own art. It's not something I take lightly, and I feel lucky every day that I get to do it. So thank you for tuning into the show, and for telling your friends, and for enjoying what we're doing here. I hope we get to do it for a long time. Happy holidays to everyone, happy new year, and we'll see you in 2019. Off camera.